continue our coverage of the Tour de France.
For cycling fans of a certain age in the United Kingdom, that music was the soundtrack to the summer. When I first heard it, I didn't know it was written by the late, great Pete Shelley of Buzzcocks fame, but something about his electronic composition felt both ultra-modern and indisputably French, with the little refrain at the end that echoes Frère Jacques, the nursery rhyme we sang in French classes at primary school. Starting in 1986, the Tour de France became a fixture of British tea time television during July, when a relatively new station, Channel 4, brought the French summer directly into our living rooms, with commentary that seemed to come to us from somewhere in the future. The Channel 4 coverage united hundreds of thousands of cycling fans previously dotted all over the country who'd had no way to watch the race as it unfolded. It also drew in many more with its introduction to the alien world of professional cycling and its beautiful lingering shots of the French countryside, the sweat and the suffering of the riders, and the sense that we were enjoying a summer holiday from the comfort of our own homes. My name is Lionel Burney, and as you heard in part one of this mini-series, Edward Pickering and I had similar experiences learning about the Tour de France through the TV highlights. That Channel 4 coverage undoubtedly influenced and inspired us, and a whole generation of British cycling journalists. It also contributed to an explosion in popularity, leading directly to the first great cycling boom in the UK, which saw the Tour de France visit southern England in 1994. In this episode, we explore the origins of the Channel 4 coverage and how it led eventually to live coverage of the Tour in the UK on both cable and terrestrial television. Graham Wilgos visited Phil Liggett, the original commentator on those Channel 4 highlights back in 86, while I spoke to James Venner, whose father Brian was responsible for putting cycling on British TV in the first place. James followed in his father's footsteps as a producer of the ITV coverage of the Tour for more than two decades. This episode is The Revolution Will Be Televised.
You're listening to Kilometre Zero by the Cycling Podcast.
Phil Liggett, the voice of cycling. Thank you for joining us on the Cycling Podcast. If I can just emphasise, the voice of cycling in this case is in capitals, because that is what you are to so many cycling fans, me included, after half a lifetime, more than half a lifetime for you, of commentating on cycling, and in particular the Tour de France. Yes. Although we haven't heard you on British television since 2015.
Yes, I was working for them, obviously, and they were my first network, but yeah, the whole world had hooked up to my voice.
Yeah.
NBC, formerly, before that it was CBS and ESPN, they all had a go at the Tour de France, and they all wanted me. They had an agreement with ITV, they could use me, but couldn't take me away. But work got so much, then the organisation wanted me to do the world feed, and all of a sudden, I didn't know who I was commentating to. And yeah, so they developed a light system. When I was working for NBC, the red light was on.
Right.
If the world feed joined us, which also included ITV towards the end, the red light was on. So we had too much light. So we knew we were talking to everyone. But then NBC would go to an ad break, which is approximately every 5 minutes. Then they would put a board between me and Sherwin. Sherwin would stay on the world feed talking to the world, and nobody explained where I'd gone. And so it got too complicated for ITV. I understand entirely. They had meetings with me. They said, look, we want more of you. And I said, I've got to be honest, what you pay me and what NBC pay me doesn't compare. And what can I say? And so they said, then we're probably going to have to say goodbye. Saddest moment of my life. I said, did you just sack me? No, that's what we've not done. We've not sacked you. I was very sad. I cried, of course. I remember Americans, NBC, rubbing their hands with Lee saying, now we've got you to ourselves. But, you know, I felt I was everybody's. I knew when the which countries were listening to me, be they South Africa, Australia, and I would pick the riders out to bring those viewers up to date as to where they were, even though in a way that America wouldn't know I was just highlighting somebody else's country, just gently and subtly. And I trained Paul Sherwin the same way. And I was very sad when the split came.
Thanks a lot, James, for sparing a bit of time to talk me through the history of the Tour de France on British television.
Well, we could try. It goes back a way, doesn't it?
It does. Well, take me back to the very beginning as you know it.
Well, first of all, ITV used to do about a sort of weekly report into a thing called World of Sport, for those that remember that. So that was done initially by a guy called David Saunders. And David used as his driver and assistant a certain Phil Liggett. And David, unfortunately, was killed in a car crash at some point. And Phil was kind of thrown into the, well, you can do it. So that's how Phil started and how Tour de France really started on British television.
When it started, it was under the guise of David Saunders was the announcer. He is the pioneer that put British cycling on television. And a great guy who never rode a bike. He was a Grenadier Guardsman when he started out. Had a wonderful voice. Sometimes a little bit difficult for him to get excited in the right places. It wasn't his style. But I made good friends with him because I employed him as our speaker on the milk race, which I organised for 22 years. And then one day, David came up to me and he said, Liggett, he always called me Liggett, said, Liggett, how do you fancy going on the Tour de France? I said, I'd love to. Why? He said, look, they're going to expand the coverage a bit more. And this would be 1975, some around there. And I said, well, I'd love to. And he said, you'll be my driver. I'll cover your expenses, but there's no fee. I said, I'm not worried about a fee, David. I can freelance my way around and get some money. That was fine. And that's how it started. And ITV backed him. And then sadly in 1978, when I'd been with David 5 years on the tour, then he got killed in a car crash. I gave him the car back after we'd driven. I had driven home from Nice. The reason that was because David was on Paris-Nice with me, and halfway through Paris-Nice, he got a note from the BBC offering a good job on what was called Superstars at the time. And this was a big break for David. And he says, would I help him out with looking after his newspaper reports? And I said, no worries. I said, get out of here. He'd got the hire car, so I brought it back to London, gave him the hire car. Before I got home, he'd been killed in it. That was the end of David, and I sat on the edge of the bath and just cried, because he was totally responsible. But he made great friends with ITV, and that was the best team I ever worked for, under John Bromley, Stuart McConaghy. These are the guys who love cycling. They believed there was a place for cycling on British television. Now, initially, all we were doing was 20-minute recaps on a Saturday for World of Sport. And I used to thank people like Sean Kelly. Sometimes we'd pee with rain on the Saturday morning, and I had to compile a week's racing, and Sean had just won the stage on this occasion. He's soaking bloody wet. And I said, Sean, please come and sit by me. I need to link you to open the show to London so they can make a show. It's only a 20-minute show. That's all finished. And he goes, yes. And I remember at the time, because, you know, the riders, and I think this will do it today, they're told the hotel, if it's rideable, they'll ride. But when you're on top of a mountain, it's peeing with rain, and somebody stuffs a note in Sean's back pocket telling him his hotel, because the cars aren't waiting while he works for me. And he just didn't hesitate, and he rode home in the wet after he spoke with me. And then out of the blue, 1980 Olympic Games in Moscow, my first Olympics. And I used to coincide with Adrian Metcalfe. He was a silver medalist in the Olympics in the 400 relay, I think it was. And so Adrian came up and sat down. He said, you know, this cycling's so bloody good. He said, listen, I'm going to tell you something in secret. There's a new television network coming out. It's going to be called Channel 4. They've asked me to be the commissioning editor for sport. And I want you to handle all the letters I get from these quirky cyclists telling me cycle races to go on TV. You tell me the ones you think should be on TV, and I'll pay you £200 a year to do that. And that's, I said, I can't believe this. And I did it. And then we got towards the mid-80s, and I was going to the Tour de France, I think it was 85. And as I went into the office in ITV to say, cheerio, lads, and I'll see you on the tour. And they said, oh, by the way, they used to call him Metters. Metters has been in. He says he's going to put the tour on Channel 4 every day live. But don't worry, it'll never happen. That was Stuart McConaughey said that, and we laughed. I said, oh, OK, well, just let me know. I'll be in France at the box. Because I was still doing my 20-minute special on the weekend for World of Sport. And Dickie Davis, my hero.
When Channel 4 launched, my father was working for a company called Transworld International, which was owned by Mark McCormack, the sports agent. And they got a contract to do city centre cycling, which was live, weekly live cycling. And then they'd been doing that for, I suppose, 2 or 3 years. And then the commissioning editor for sport, a guy called Adrian Metcalf, suggested that they might like to do the Tour de France. And that was in 1986. I think prior to that, Channel 4 had done, they did certainly the 85 tour, and that was produced by ITV for Channel 4. But from 86, it was a completely, if you, for want of a better term, Channel 4 operation. And because of that, my dad conceived the idea that it should be presented sort of very visibly from Channel 4. And so they, at the time, Channel 4's headquarters were in Charlotte Street. So the idea came about that we would present the programme from the reception area. So people wandering past in the street could kind of see what was going on. And the presenter back then was Nick Owen.
Richard Keys?
Yes, Richard Keys came in the year after, in 87. Yeah. Nick Owen did 86 and then went off to do Breakfast TV with Ann Diamond. And it was a half-hour show. I think it was sort of 6:30, 7 o'clock.
Including coast-to-coast coverage on television in the United States. Phil Liggett now describes the media entourage that tells the world about the Tour de France.
Well, you know, here in France, they all talk of two Tours de France. One, of course, is for the riders. The second one is for the journalists who try to follow the race. There are over 500 writing journalists here. There are hundreds of
pressure. And so I sat down on the box one day, and all of a sudden I'm told I'm speaking directly to the studio in London, Channel 4, and they were covering the race from start to finish. It happened. There's me, no director, nobody else, just me and the television. I'm comparatively inexperienced, certainly calling a live race forever and ever. And then the guy says, don't worry, he said, I'll tell you what the pictures are when they come up, because you won't see them straight away because they're in London, but you are live, so be careful. And then he would say something like, okay, the theme music is up now. Da, 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 da. He says, we're opening with a full scenic of the race across the fields, and the riders in the shots. And I remember saying, hello and welcome to the roads of the Tour de France. now opening its race on stage number one, we're going from A to B. Then the guy says, we're now showing the overall standings, or the overall, it must have, couldn't have been stage one, because he actually said we're showing the overall situation, must have been a couple of days down the road. And I said, well, there you have the latest standings, the general classification. I couldn't see it, but I knew what he'd be showing. And then he said, that's gone now. He says, now we're coming to you with live pictures. And so I said, well, there are the standings, and now live action on the road, and we'll catch up with the pictures. That's how it started. And the whole of that year, that tour, that's how it was. And it, don't forget the weekend, I did my 20-minute compilation for Stuart McConaughey and John Bromley back home. So I was a busy lad by myself, and it taught me a lot of television fast. Because, you know, everybody knows the sport, but when I sit young commentators down beside me who think they know it all, they freeze. Because when that light turns green, you've got to know what you're going to say. And I can see how they changed when they thought they knew all. But yeah. TV is quite difficult. But I love live TV, and now I was in my element, absolutely yeah. in my element. And so it was a big success. That was one of Channel 4's very first programmes. The other one was Countdown. And I think the viewing figures were the maximum they could account for, which is around 200,000. But they were very, very pleased in Channel 4. So next year, they decided to employ a production house. It was called Television, Sport and Leisure, I think. Anyway, I sat down, same direction for a while. But when I got the job for the second year, I had a phone call from a guy called Brian Venner. And he goes, are you Phil Liggett? I said, yes. And then he said, well, I've never heard of you, but I'm told I've got to employ you. I said, well, who are you? He said, I'm doing the Tour de France next year. And you are apparently going to be my commentator. Well, that was 55, 60 years ago. And Brian and I, and Brian's in his 90s now, we are still close friends.
Mm.
Yeah, and that's how it started.
Back to the beginning. Because I remember those World of Sport inserts every Saturday, sort of lunchtime or early afternoon. You know, it's hot, sunny days. My dad was a cycling fan, so he was kind of waiting for it. And we'd have World of Sport on, and they'd go to the, I don't know, the horse racing, and then something else, and then something else. They weren't always terribly good at telling you when to kind of pay attention and look out for it.
No, well, I think, again, World of Sport was one of those shows which had, you know, it had a whole range of sports thrown into it. And they probably didn't know themselves when any, for them, Tour de France would have been a little bit of a filler that they'd put in whenever they needed it, rather than it having a regular, you know, time that it was going out. Mm. You know, World of Sport's staple was horse racing and wrestling. They were the two linchpins of it. And everything else kind of slotted in around that. Nevertheless, you can credit them with, you know, they were the first to show cycling on British television.
Yeah.
I think Liggett's first commentary was a race at Crystal Palace. I'm not quite sure what it was. It was post-tour, I think. So kind of a one-day race at Crystal Palace. It was the first time he actually got on the microphone.
So that first tour that you did for Channel 4,
yeah.
At what point did you feel kind of comfortable and that you really felt like you had a handle on it? Or maybe that point never came until you finished it and you got to the end of the tour and sort of thought, blimey, okay, mission accomplished.
I felt I knew it all, but I really thought after my first commentary, I wouldn't get the job back. I remember saying, now you have the world champion Jerry Kinnettum breaking wind at the front. I thought, well, that's blown me off the network. The thing about live TV is you either got your P45 or you're still working after the show, you know.
Yeah. But you've got a background, you had a background in cycling before yes. that. You were making your way as a professional cyclist, or that
Trying
was your
to.
Yeah, that was your hope.
Yeah.
So how did you go from there into, how do you wind up in the commentary box from starting out riding a bike?
Well, it was sadly the accident to David. ITV knew me because David used to take me into the studios. I was in awe and things like that. And they knew I was okay on the microphone, but they said to me, they rang me up the next day. They said, look, Phil, we've had so many applicants for David's job, and from the minute he died, the letters were here. He says, and we don't like that. So we decided we're not having any interviews. If you want the job, then you've got it. I said, the last thing I want is people to think I've jumped into his dead shoes, because that is not me. They said, they won't. They said, we're telling you now, if you want the job, we think you can do it. You'll learn the hard way. It's a live show at Crystal Palace in April, and it's a 45-minute show, and we think you can do it. And that's how I got the job. And you learn as you go. Well, I have learned is you can make mistakes and you don't get sacked, but...
It feels like you followed your nose. So you went from being following a professional career as a writer to... I'm going to say you fell into journalism because you felt like the British writers that you were writing with weren't getting a sort of fair crack of the whip.
That is correct.
From Cycling Magazine.
Correct.
And you were writing in Belgium. Mm. And so you started to phone race reports in.
Yeah, that's correct. And I was grateful for the £15 they paid me every Sunday night from...
After racing, though. So you would race and then you'd phone the report in.
Yes. Yeah. And I remember that the British champion, Pete Matthews, when I was doing that around and racing in Britain, when I got... After I came back in 66, I had a contract to go and give it a go in 67. And I had a phone call from Cycling Magazine, Cycling and Mopeds, as it was called in those days.
Right.
Alan Gaffer was the boss, who always wore a bow tie. And in fact, put me up for 6 weeks in his private home, which I thought was incredibly kind, because I didn't know him.
Because you'd have come down from Liverpool to
I
London.
I came from Liverpool, never been. When I told Mum I was going
to stay.
To London to work, she said, what are you going down there for? It's full of them Southerners. I said, yes, Mum, I'm going to work in Fleet Street, but I'll probably come back next week. Well, that was 1967, the March of 67, and I haven't been back since, and poor old Mum has long since passed. But I got the job. Alan called me over today, said, look, we know you raced, yeah, and you realise you can't race anymore now. And I thought, I didn't answer up in the back of my mind, so yeah, right. Because of a racing was my life still.
Mm.
But I was now a journalist. And so I said to Alan, okay, whatever. But I did start racing. And then he started getting letters saying about the fact that it was good to see you had a cyclist on your staff now and knew what he was doing. And then I won a big race on the Willesden Handicap off scratch on the Isle of Man during the Isle of Man week. And I dropped everybody in the scratch group. And I won the race. I chased some kid called Mike. Anyway, he went to the Commonwealth Games, and the Isle of Man were very proud of him, and I caught him about a quarter of a mile from the finish and won. And so that was the Willesden Handicap. And then I got a letter from the top man at IPC, which is now called Reed, and he said, cannot believe that you're able to report the racing like you have done, and you can win as well. Fantastic for the magazine. Thank you. That was that. Then Gaffer called me over and said, look, we know you're racing. It's obvious by now.
When I've told you not to.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he said, because it's good for the magazine, the only races you can ride at weekends are the biggest race of the day. And at the same time, report it. And he says, if you're late back into work on the Sunday night, because that was our press evening, and reporting all the day's races and stuff, he said, I'll sack you. And we were friends, and he would have sacked me. I said, okay, Alan, I've got the message. I'll do what I can. But I was getting thinner and thinner and thinner. And so...
Because you're working double time, and you're having to travel to the races as well,
yeah,
presumably.
Yeah, travel to the races. I never stayed overnight.
Yeah.
And I had to be back in the office by 5 or 6 o'clock, and I could be... phoning a story as well, because I was probably writing for The Guardian at the time, stopping in coin boxes, doing a reverse charge. Trish would drive while I was writing stories. It was ridiculous. But it worked, and I was loving every minute of it. But in one big race, I got in the break with about 6 or 7 riders, and I couldn't work. These guys were training. I was riding my bike maybe twice a week if I was lucky, usually racing as well. I didn't do any training. And this guy kept threatening to punch me if I didn't get to the front and do some work in the break, you see. And Pete Matthews, who was the British champion at the time and one of the nicest guys, and I used to race against him a lot when I was really trying hard. And
from the same neck of the woods as
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah. It was Liverpool Mercury. It's the two big clubs that were the Mercury and the Kirby Cycling Club.
Yeah.
I never joined them. I liked to be on the other side of the water, so I was in the Birkenhead North End. And I was on the back. I was riding for a London club now, not the Birkenhead North End. And this guy kept saying, get to the front line. And I said, I'm genuinely bothered, I said. But he didn't know me from Adam, just riding a race. So Pete came back. He said, leave him alone. And he says, he's all right. He's writing the story for Cycling Magazine. He's got a typewriter in his back pocket, and it's very heavy. He won't win the race, so just leave him where he is. I said, phew, thanks, Pete. And, of course, he's right. I would never have tried to win the race, but I did write the story.
Yeah. So we fast forward to that first tour, back to that first tour with Channel 4. What was the best advice you were given? Were you given any advice before you went into the commentary box?
No. I got to the commentary box. This was the one in Alexander, Crystal Palace.
Yeah.
And then 5 minutes before airtime, which is 25 past one, on the Saturday afternoon, Dickie Davis rang me. I couldn't believe he was ringing me. And Dickie goes, hello, old Sonny. He always called everybody old Sonny. He said, it's Dickie here. Hi, Dickie. He said, now listen, I just want to wish you well. It's a lovely day. There's a big field. Because I'd organised the race. I brought 88 professionals, including Bernard Thévenet and all the world's best riders. Thévenet just won the Tour de France, etc. And it was a big deal. And I was now the organiser and the commentator. So I had to put my thumb out the window to start the race in line with the TV. So I was sat there talking to Dickie and he says, just remember why you got the job. I said, well, that's the first problem, Dickie. I'm not sure why I got the job. Because they liked you. No other reason. So don't change. No posh voices when you start talking. Be the person you were when you climb that ladder. Only advice I ever had, and it's the only advice I gave Paul Sherwin as well. We took you, Paul, because you like you, so don't worry about it.
You're seeing here now a man of extreme courage. Kelly's collarbone is fractured, and yet he's trying to ride on. This is a dreadful day in the Tour de France. It's happened before he's even got to the mountain. A simple crash has taken out one of the great favourites in the Tour de France, and suddenly it all comes home. Sean Kelly.
So tell me a little more about, you've mentioned him a couple of times, your partnership with Paul Sherwin. 33 years, I think I'm right in saying that you were the sort of the dynamic duo, one of the most, or if not the most famous sort of commentary partnerships, certainly on British TV. How did that come about, and was the chemistry between you natural, or was it something you worked on together?
No, totally natural. We were born about 12 miles apart and 12 years difference in age. Paul was going to France 10 years before he came to the TV, and he was going to Boulogne-Billancourt. And he, I was invited to the Altrincham Road Cycling Club to do a farewell speech for Paul. I'd only known him winning Pernod Grand Prix, Hart Lagers and things like that, and he's clearly class. So I remember making the speech and said, there's no doubt this young lad, Paul Sherwin, will go to France and he will be he'll be a big success. And I didn't really speak to him again for a couple of years. And then, of course, over those 10 years, I kept seeing him at the start line of the Tour de France and stuff. And we had a little thing. He used to see me with all the press guys and he would... In those days, they had a food wagon for the riders in the Tour right by the start line. And he'd go and get me half a grapefruit and bring it over. Here's your breakfast. And that became a tradition. I got a half a grapefruit to eat by, before they shot off down the road, not like the current days now. And we were always friends. It wasn't a forced friendship. It just happened. And then I read in the newspaper towards the end of his career that he was coming back to England. He only had two teams in his pro career, Fiat and La Redoute. And I read he was coming back to race in Britain and then he was going to retire. So I thought, I told the TV and they said, well, there's no room for him just now, but see what you think. Have a word with him. I said, okay. So I went on, it was on the Pyrenees race. Champs-Élysées was a split stage. So when he finished the road race stage, I didn't go up the Col d'Aise, so I went home on the way home. I said, hey, are you packing in? Well, not actually packing in, he says. I'm just going to come back to Britain, ride for 2 years, in which he won two British championships, eventually. And then I said, okay. I said, well, just bear in mind one day, maybe you'd like to work alongside me on TV. And he goes, yeah, maybe I would. I'll give you. I'll think about that. I said, thanks. Okay. I said, but when you wouldn't tell me who you're signing for. So I said, listen, whoever you're signing for, because the work will be during your 2 years racing in Britain, said, just write in your contract, no racing in the month of July, because I think you'd be alongside me on the Tour de France. And he did. He put in his contract. Then I had a phone call from George Shaw from TI Rally. And George and I were reasonable mates, but I'd never had any inkling he was going to sign Paul. He goes, hello, Phil George. I said, hi, George. He said, listen, I've had a strange request. Paul Sherwin. I said, are you signing him? Oh, yeah. He said, but he's put in his contract at no racing during the month of July. I said, George, I've got every chance he's got a career in television with me. There'll be no objection to him wearing a TI Rally top in the commentary box, because ITV are fine with that. And, you know, we'll use him a lot more. We mic him up and stuff and get him in amongst the riders, which we did in the Tour of Britain after that. And he said, no problems with that at all, he said. So he signed the contract with Paul, deal was done, and then Paul came to the TV and the rest is history. And you're right, 33 years, it's apparently a world record. Paul was very proud of it. He found the record. He says, don't forget, we've been bloody 33 years together now. I said, I know, it feels like it too, you know, because we never had a bad word. We sat on TV together. We never tripped over each other.
Yeah.
If I had something to say, I'd squeeze his knee.
Yeah.
If he had something to say, he'd sit there with one finger in the air and I'd stop talking. He'd take over. It was very good. We were naturals together.
How do you think of him when you've got that picture in your mind? How do you think of the two of you together? Do you think of the two of you in the commentary box, or do you think, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of Paul?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. I think about him every day now.
Mm.
Every day. He's been dead since 2018. And never a day goes by. I look at the wall, I see something on the wall, remember him, or find a picture of him on the files. We just did everything together. On the tour, we were well known. The people thought we were twins because the organisation, how are the English doubles again? You know, and it was because we did everything. He was the same type of person as me. He was we're not Scouse. We're Cheshire people, but we can make a Scouse accent sound good. And Paul used to put a cup of coffee outside my bedroom door at 6:30. I'd open the door, take it off the mat, and I'd have it while we get ready. We would go to breakfast at the same time, and both doors would open and close at the same time as we went down. So we never arranged it. We never not didn't eat together at night for dinner. Because people used to say, do you mind if we sit with you tonight? I said, no, come and sit with us. What's the matter? But we never thought, realise it. We used to tell stories. Paul is no longer with us, but hey, he's with me every day.
And was it a difficult decision to carry on without him?
No, there was no decision because I was still under contract. I couldn't throw the contract in the air. And also the television networks didn't want me to leave, which was very nice. Primarily NBC said, you're going nowhere. We've got you. And in fact, they offered me a contract for life, which they said they'd only ever done once before, and that was for a golfing commentator. So they said, you give us 1 year's notice so we can find a replacement. That's the deal. I said, I'm not sure I want a contract for life. I've tried three times so far, and I'm 82 now. I've tried three times to say, guys, it's about time you took someone else. Why? We check the figures. Whenever you're on the air, they go up. And you still got your marbles. I listen to you to make sure before I say you can come back next year. So I'm still there.
This message is brought to you by the Capital One Venture X card. Venture X offers the premium benefits you expect, like a $300 annual Capital One travel credit for less than you expect. Elevate your earn with unlimited double miles on every purchase, bringing you one step closer to your next dream destination. Plus, enjoy access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. The Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Everything was edited using existing facilities within Channel 4, and so we had to, the edit suite was literally alongside the transmission suite. When Channel 4 launched, they were the first in this country to have this computerized transmission system, which meant all the details of the program had to be put into the computer and all the switching happened automatically, and there wasn't much the transmission controller could do to stop the computer switching when it thought it was going to switch. And that meant that they were, should we say, anxious about getting all the, you know, the durations of the parts, and that they were used to having everything hours, even days in advance. And of course, we were sort of sitting in the room next door still editing it, and they couldn't quite get the concept that, you know, part one was maybe transmitting, but part two wasn't finished yet. And no, we couldn't give them a duration quite yet. But all the while, this was still just a half-hour show. And indeed, amongst ourselves, you know, we were discussing whether we should lengthen it, whether there was scope for making a longer programme. Some people said, yes, definitely. And other people said, don't be ridiculous. How could we make a longer programme? The only thing we could do is put extra racing in, which seemed to me to be kind of the point. But anyway, that was the argument. And Channel 4 never really wanted more than the half hour that they got, and it never moved beyond that until we moved to ITV. The history behind that was that Channel 4 signed up the cricket, and cricket being cricket tends to run all day. They couldn't guarantee that 6:30, 7 o'clock slot because the cricket would run into it. So they tried for a couple of years pushing the thing to 10, 11 o'clock at night, and that didn't suit a lot of the audience. And they got a lot of complaints about it. And in the end, they just said, look, we don't need all this level of complaint about it. Yeah, we'd rather just step back.
Those early days, sort of 86 through to sort of the early 90s, I suppose the first era of it is up to the point where the tour came to Britain. It's certainly when I think of it, 94, because then there was a lot more awareness of the Tour de France as a result of the stages that were in Britain. Just the you know, Channel 4 was a risk-taking channel. It was brand new. It had a remit to kind of look at things that were a bit different. It had done a lot of American sports, hadn't it? The NBA and the NFL and cycling, kabaddi, you know, there was an alternative feel to the things that Channel 4 was doing.
To a point of the perversity that they would, you know, they would do the things that nobody else would touch. You know, and it just happened that, I mean, cycling was the one that, and the tour in particular, was the one big major sports event that nobody else covered. And Adrian Metcalf came in and said, why is this? And, you know, it's something we can do, and it's a major sports event, and it's a proper sports event. It's not, you know, there's no sort of jokiness about it. It's a proper full-on sports event, and it's something that's available to us, which no one else is doing. So, you know, to that extent, yes, there was a risk that no one would want to watch it, and we didn't have as I mentioned earlier, we didn't have any British stars. You know, it wasn't a British success story, which is what normally drives things. I think what attracted people initially, a large part of the audience were, you know, it was pretty pictures of France and where they went on holiday last year, and, you know, just seeing the scenery. And the bike race was almost incidental to that. And then you had obviously a core cycling audience that had come for the racing, but a big part of the audience that was quite happy at, you know, 6:30 on a weekday evening to sort of sit down and see some pretty pictures of France.
Absolutely. I mean, that chimes with my childhood. We went on holiday to places that we'd seen on Tour de France coverage, you know, whether it was the cathedral in Reims, or, you know, down on the south coast, or wherever it was. I mean, my dad was a Francophile anyway. He'd been to Saint-Tropez on holiday in the early 60s, and, you know, when that one perhaps wasn't the most common thing to do. And the Tour de France, as I said, was that window into a place that you look similar, but just also completely different to the UK. And
France is, you know, it's France in the north is a completely different place to France in the south as well. So, you know, I think, you know, the tour transitions through, you know, completely different zones of France, and each one gives you a different feel.
And the travel log aspect of it, or just vicariously kind of going on a 3-week holiday, it was as strong then as it is now. That was probably one of the things that drew in that initial audience of people who perhaps weren't there for the sport as much as they were for the routine and the kind of the unfolding roadshow and the drama and all of the rest of it.
So the job for us was trying to, you knew that's why a lot of people were coming, and you had to draw them into the sport as well, and explain the sport. And I think, you know, by the time that Channel 4 stopped showing it, you know, we began to get, there was an element of the audience that was saying, you know, I'm ready for the next, you know, I'm okay, I've had the beginner's guide, I'm ready for the next installment, as it were. And then you had the challenge of how do you move it on? How do you get a bit more sophisticated, but without leaving behind the people who, you know, don't understand the tactics of cycle racing? How do you keep explaining that without the experienced people going, I know all this, don't keep telling me the same thing. You know, so that was always a challenge.
I think that remains a challenge for all of us, really. I think we forget at our peril that there are new people coming along all the time, and that it has to be, you know, a bit of an arm around the shoulder to usher people into this kind of wacky world and the customs of it and the history and the...
Absolutely. You know, it's very easy to assume that just because you understand it, that everybody else understands it. And, you know, there is a big part of an audience that still doesn't. I mean, you've got to find a way of explaining things without it being patronizing to the people who are newly joining, and without it being overly basic to the people who've been watching for 40 years. And there was a year, 2001, ITV agreed to take it, but came on board very late that year, so late that there wasn't time to open the schedules up fully. And so we did in that one year, we did weekly reports, did a 1-hour show each week for 2001. And then from 2002 onwards, it was an hour's highlights a night. And we started doing live programs at the weekends and then Sunday. And again, that kind of persisted. Ooh, I'm just trying to remember the year when it all changed and we went to live every day and what have you. But really the driver behind that was the French deciding they were going to cover the race all day long. What many people perhaps don't realise is that the coverage of the race is done by French TV. And initially they would only cover 2 to 3 hours at the end of each day. And it was relatively recently, I'm thinking 2010, 2011, that they decided that they could cover all day, every day. They'd sort of dipped their toe again with, you know, selected stages, 4 or 5 stages through the tour, which they would do live in their entirety prior to that. But really, you know, it wasn't until quite late you know, quite relatively recently that there was all-day coverage available.
So, Phil, you've been kind enough to invite me into your home so that you and I can have a chat.
Sure.
You've shown me on the way through to, we've got a beautiful view of your garden, but you show me your yellow jersey on the wall. Mm. And that was to commemorate your 50th tour.
Yes.
This summer, 2026, will be your 53rd tour or 54th?
I think it's 54 now. I'm losing count myself.
Yeah.
Every year we have the joke about, you can't even remember how long you've been here. So I'm working on it. No, my first tour was 73 anyway, and we're now in 26.
So. Yeah. It's. I think it's quite right that you've got that yellow jersey on the wall. I think a lot of people will agree. But you must be proud to have it up there as well.
I'm very proud. The organisation were very good to Paul when he passed away. They came to his memorial service in Manchester, Christian Prudhomme. Everybody from the senior staff came and made a big deal because they were still discussing with Brussels the Tour de France starting there to commemorate the great stage victories of Eddy Merckx, and they stopped by.
Mm.
And I said, Christian, thank you so much for coming. He says, Phil, we want to be here. We're going to Brussels straight from here by train to carry on negotiations for the tour. But he came. And so Christian sent me an incredible WhatsApp on my phone when I sat at the start of the tour after Paul died, which would be 2019. It just goes, "Dearest Phil, I'm thinking of you today without your friend Paul. We all miss him, and I've kept that text for life because it's just a simple couple of words. Until that point in time, I'd never had a message from Christian Prudhomme in my life." Anyway, they decided, the girls who were doing all the press media on the tour, they know I'm as soon as I'm off air, I'm into my car. My driver's waiting to get me the hell out of this because we could have a 200 or 300 kilometre drive to the next hotel.
Yeah, of course.
Like dinner.
Yeah.
And they said, "Phil, tonight you must not leave so quickly." I said, "What? No, we just want to say a little message to you. Just come round behind the television at 6 o'clock. I said, "Okay." So I went round at 6 o'clock and they had a long wooden table with a typical French buffet, you know, cheese and red wine and a couple of bottles of beer, and that was it. And no expense spared. And all the girls were there and I started telling them stories about my life in Africa and the animals and stuff. And then the PR men came over as well. We had a good, just a friendly, I've been going for years, don't forget, so they're all pretty cool to me. And then up behind me, tap on the shoulder. I was on my right shoulder. I turned around. I said, "Christian," it was like he was like apologizing for coming to what was a private party, and he's the boss. And I said, "Christian, nice to see you." He said, "Phil, this is for you." And it was a wrapped up maillot jaune. When he unwrapped it, it has his signature and the signature of the only other living race director now, which is Jean-Marie Leblanc, who's retired. And the morning of that stage, Jean-Marie was at the start. I didn't know, and Christian got it signed by him. He said, "This is for you," he says, "and I want to tell you, it is the first maillot jaune I have ever signed in my life for anyone." And I cracked. I said, "What can I say, Christian? Thank you for all you've done for me." "No," he said, "thank you for what you've done for the tour over 50 years. You've made us very famous." And it was fantastic.
Mm.
Let me ask you a question about your father, Brian. Was he interested in cycle racing and the Tour de France prior to this, or was it just because he was in the world of sports television and this was an opportunity?
He'd been the producer of Grandstand for since the mid-60s to about the mid-70s. No, cycling wasn't a particular interest. He left the BBC, as I said, to join this company, TWI. And one of the first things that he was set to do was the guy that ran the tour at the time was a guy called Félix Leviton, who was the tour director. And Leviton was, he had this big idea of taking the tour to New York. And TWI were kind of on the edges of exploring whether that could be done and whether there was any deal to be made. And Brian was sent out to the Tour to go and meet with Levitan and sort of kind of open discussions. So we had a day in the car with Levitan in the lead car. I was absolutely amazed at this guy screaming into radios and calling up motorbikes and helicopters and basically speeding past everything. And people were coming up to the car window and shouting things through the window. And so, you know, he'd never seen anything like it. So he was amazed at that. And then really it was by chance that the city centre cycling was offered to him. And that kind of got him into cycling.
Welcome to Bristol, where tonight a large bank holiday crowd has gathered for round three in the Kellogg City Centre Cycling Championship. Well, the streets around the cathedral were closed to traffic just a short time ago. The riders came down onto the start line, and tonight they include one of the big stars from the last Tour de France, Frank Host of Belgium, the man who won the points championship, which made him the top sprinter on the Tour. And that also means that he's going to give quite a challenge tonight to the man alongside him, Alan Piper of Australia, who leads our own King of the Sprints competition. But tonight, of course, we've also got the continuation of the main championship, which lies at the moment between two English riders, Malcolm Elliott out in front and Phil Thomas, the defending champion.
Then, because he was producing cycling for Channel 4, Adrian Metcalf then said, how about you do the Tour de France? So it came about by accident, really.
It's difficult from the perspective we have now with so much live sport, and we can all watch the Tour de France from kilometre zero to the finish line every day if we wish, which lends it a different rhythm and a different quality. And there was something about watching those half-hour highlight shows, and almost they don't feel like highlight shows because they felt so live. They felt like we were watching live sport, especially the second half after the ad break. There was a kind of a rhythm to it, wasn't there? There was a kind of like, what's happened so far? And now we're at the second half was very much what's happened on the two last climbs or whatever.
Part of that is forced on, you know, but because you've got so little time to turn it round, you are concentrating your editing on, let's tell the story to a certain point, and then we can join it here, you know, and we can then it's just a question of subbing down, you know, the last half hour or hour or whatever it might be, whether, as you say, whether that's the last climb or what have you. And there were one or two occasions when we were actually live I think the first occasion was when Fabio Casatelli was killed. And the day after, the riders decided they were going to kind of allow the Motorola team to come in together and cross the line together. And they'd just gone very slowly through the day. So they hadn't, in fact, finished by the time we went on air. And so we took the decision that we were just going to come on air to them rolling in live, you know, and we very hastily, you know, had to shove, because in those days, Phil Liggett was also presenting the program. So we couldn't have him in the commentary box and on the camera. So Gary Imlach had to, who was our reporter, had to go on the camera and become the presenter. And we put him on the roof of the van, which was close to the finish line. And literally, we rolled the titles and went straight to him, and then to the live pictures as the race came in. And that, so we were actually live as it happened on that day, just forced by it.
And now Van Aert across the road, and the riders holding themselves off at a respectful distance to an applause the Tour de France has never known before. The Motorola team remember Fabio Casatelli.
James, I remember that day so vividly, coming home and watching that stage. And of course, without the internet in those days, and you know, I would not look at teletext or CFAX because I didn't want to spoil the result. That broadcast left such an impression on me because it was where sport was colliding with really hard news and a tragic outcome. and an unknown situation as well. You know, there was still, I think, some doubt of what had happened, and you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I got to say, from our point of view, there wasn't much doubt. But, I mean, having seen the pictures live, it was quite obvious that it was not a good outcome. We were lucky, you know, we had people like my dad around who were, you know, very experienced broadcasters. And, you know, if you like, some of our instinct was to say, oh, we've got to come, go back and tell the story of the day as it happened. And he said, no, we run the titles and we come straight off to, you know, the news that the guy's dead. And, you know, that's the way you do news. You lead with, you know, you lead with your headline, as it were. So then after that, we go back and tell the story. But you've got to play the headline.
I wondered what part in the kind of the growth in popularity of cycling in the UK you feel those early programmes on Channel 4, you know, because a whole wave of interest came off the back of that.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? As I say, there was no outstanding British success in the race till 2012. Yet somehow it was always one of those shows that, you know, I mean, to give you an example, you'd be renewing your car insurance and they'd say, what's your occupation? TV producer. Well, what do you produce? Tour de France. Oh, I never miss that. You know, and that was a sort of universal reaction that you got, which I have to say didn't quite marry up with the audience figures, but, you know, by the by. So the answer is they must have had some effect. I think it had a sort of more of a cultural, as I say, I think there was more of a, this sort of, you know, shots of France. I think the interest in the sport came as success came, you know, with Wiggins and Froome and what have you. Mm. And it's, you know, it's scenery. There was, of course, the whole Lance Armstrong era, which, let's not forget, for most of it was a story of a guy who'd beaten cancer coming back to do this amazing thing. And even though those of us close to it were suspicious, nothing that you could prove otherwise until quite late on. So I think there was that which kind of carried it in a way. You know, but through the 90s, you had Miguel Indurain winning five races in a row. He didn't speak a word of English. I can't believe that drove much of a British audience. So what are you left with? It came through the track cycling, didn't it, in the Olympics? And so I think that again began to push a bit of cycling interest. And that combined with Armstrong and then you got the British success coming in, kind of led us to a better place.
Your early years with Channel 4 coincided with English-speaking, not necessarily British riders, but certainly English-speaking riders starting to dominate the sport. So I'm thinking of Greg LeMond.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of Stephen Roach. So certainly Sean Kelly, you know, certainly with Paris Nice, if not at the Tour. Yeah. So you had, it was that sort of beautifully serendipitous moment for your career in that you could build a relationship with them, presumably.
I did. And, you know, I honestly, when I first went to the early tours, I never thought we'd ever call a British winner. But now I've called English-speaking winners from all over the world. What a wonderful occasion it was when I called Stephen Roach in 1987, doing the triple as well. And Greg, when he won, and after all the doping scandals, he's still the only American to have won it.
Mm.
And Greg was very obliging to me when I wanted to interview. So it was a bit awkward to interview. He didn't, you know, I got a problem, I got to go. But he always said, no, send him up, I'll speak to him. And so we got away with it. And yeah, they were, well, America went mad. I did the final interview after he won the Tour. And he was over the moon. I remember Andy Hampson had finished fourth and pulled on the white jersey, final white jersey. And what Greg said in an interview, this guy will win the Tour one day too, which Andy came close, but he didn't. So I was on top of a bus on the Champs-Élysées, and because of the time difference, it was approaching midnight in France to get the prime time in the States.
Mm.
And Greg was in no hurry to leave. He had a boat booked on the Seine for a big party, and he was happy to be there to be seen around the States. And that was a big thing for CBS, it was at the time. And it really boosted the figures out of sight. And then, of course, along came Roach, and then we got the spate of Robert Miller and the British winners that followed, like Chris Froome and Brad Wiggins. It was just wonderful. Geraint Thomas, who was probably the most underrated winner ever, because he seemed to come in the background. He gave Wales its first ever victory.
Mm.
I had to explain to the Americans where Wales was to start with.
Mm.
They don't understand the UK and Great Britain, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, and all of a sudden it was a worldwide tour now. And I felt I played quite a major part in helping it get there too, working through ITV. Because ITV was a very special company.
I was wondering as well on that sort of late 80s period, and there was the 1987 tour, and I think the finish was to Lagnac. And you had this
Lagnac in the rain.
The most extraordinary storm, and it wiped out... I think it wiped out the monitors, so you had no pictures, but you were able to commentate, but you had nothing to commentate on.
It was quite funny. We were working as normal. The weather was great. It was down by Aerospatiale, and we'd been warned there was going to be a very heavy storm, and it got blacker and blacker. And as the race was coming in, it was a bunch. The race were ploughing in towards Blagnac. I'd never seen a storm like it. I mean, this was torrential. And in those days, we only had a tarpaulin cover over a sort of scaffolding kit. And underneath the tarpaulin cover was all the TV sets and the telephone.
Mm.
And it suddenly collapsed. The water got so heavy and it splashed everybody's monitor. Poof. Everybody's off air. My phone rings and it's Brian Venner, the infamous Brian Venner. He's in London. Liggett, I've got perfect pictures and so have the British viewers. So tell us what the hell is going on. So I've got any pictures, Brian. Don't worry, I'll tell you who's at the front and you just put it on air. Well, Brian, I love him to bits. He knows nothing about bloody cycling.
Right.
He just said, there's a guy in a blue jersey leading them out. And I thought, this is Panasonic. And they're trying to get Phil Anderson across the line. And so I just built it up, you know, well, there you've got the Panasonic team. They're looking forward to try and get the Kangaroo through again and stuff like this. And we went on for a quarter. The guys who were off air, the Dutch commentators, the Bells, they came to look at my monitor because it's covered. You've got covers on it. They turned in, they looked in the hole, and there's nothing on. And Paul goes, don't worry, he's doing it on the phone. Eh? He's doing it on the phone. There's a guy in London telling you what the pictures are like. Ah, les anglais. They walked away. They thought I was mad. Well, the accolades that flowed after that, because people at home didn't know.
Yeah.
And Brian's on my documentary, Voice of Cycling, is saying it. He said, I've never seen a piece of television like it.
Yeah, because he was...
thought he could see what he was calling. And I was just happy to do my job. That's all I've ever been happy to do. If you do it, you do it, don't you?
This message is brought to you by the Capital One Venture X card. Venture X offers the premium benefits you expect, like a $300 annual Capital One travel credit for less than you expect. Elevate your earn with unlimited double miles on every purchase, bringing you one step closer to your next dream destination. Plus, enjoy access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. The Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
The features were the thing that set it apart. And, you know, Gary Imlach standing on outside a cafe or next to a monument or whatever it was in a market square, wherever, you know, they are the images for cycling that James Richardson would later do in the Italian piazza for the Football Italia. You know, they were the things that drew us into the connection between the sporting event and the place it was taking place.
I mean, interestingly, James Richardson did a year for us on the tour when Gary was doing American football said he couldn't do the tour. And so James was the guy we pulled in to do that. And this was prior to Football Italia. So maybe he learnt it from us, I don't know. And then, of course, when it switched from Channel 4 to ITV, because we had the live element at the weekends, Phil Liggett could no longer be the presenter. because he was in the commentary box. So Gary became the full-time presenter. And we then had to find another reporter. And we went through a series of people, largely because they were contracted to ITV. So they were free to us, as it were. They were already being paid by ITV. And Ned was the one we eventually landed on. I think, I'm just trying to think when Ned's first tour was, about 2003.
Wasn't it?
I think he was so traumatized by it that swore he'd never come back. And we had to kind of take him out to lunch and sit him down and persuade him. and the rest is history, as they say.
You mentioned there the journalistic aspect of things. I mean, that was an important part of the show as well. I mean, I'm thinking about the Festina scandal, where no one that was close to the Tour de France wanted the sport to combust the way it did. And yet we all had this kind of thirst for the truth, the knowledge, the story, the news. And it's where I really sometimes wonder in sports broadcasting, when there are scandals, there's sometimes a tendency or a desire to sort of look the other way or minimize and focus on the show. And in 98, there's no way that your team could be accused of that.
No, you're on dangerous ground there, because you've got to cover what's happening. I mean, you know, on the same basis, you'd say, well, don't worry about whether rider X has tested positive or not. Just, not good for the sport, just ignore it and keep quiet. And you can't do that, can you? So, I mean, Festina in 98, as I recall, it began coming out in the days just prior to the start of the tour in Dublin. And, one of the team cars, the Festina car, had been stopped crossing a border somewhere, and they discovered these drugs in the car. And I think what's important for people to remember was, at that point, you know, that you've got the French police launching investigations and questioning people, but it had nothing to do with whether someone was cheating at cycling. They were investigating where the drugs had come from and the fact they disappeared from a hospital in France somewhere. So it was about theft of drugs from a hospital and not to do with whether, you know, the Festina team were cheating at sport. But it obviously impacted, because, you know, you had police raiding hotels either at night or early morning. Riders complaining about being raided, and you think, well, would you rather they raided at 9 in the morning and stop you going to the start and you're out of the tour? They've done you the decency of raiding at 6 in the morning, and, you know, at least you can stay in the race. You know, or they've come at night. And it was only subsequently that you realised that this wasn't about one team. It was about just about all of them, and how far it went. I remember the first weekend was, it kind of opened as normal, and it was all a bit, there was a subtext going on, and it didn't really break until the race got back to France on the Monday. And suddenly, A, the French police were in action, and B, you know, everyone's lawyers were back at work. And so suddenly this thing then exploded into something much bigger. And, you know, very fortunately for us, we had Gary Imlach as our reporter, who was, you know, his background was in news. And so, you know, we had someone there who was absolutely rock solid on reporting news. If you're Phil Liggett, how the hell do you call a race finish? You can't every day be saying, but is what we're watching real? Mm-hmm. You know, all you can do is call what's happening and let other people kind of sweep up who's tested positive and who hasn't, and who's bullying who. You know, very difficult to strike that balance. I hope we managed it reasonably. You know, there are still people who felt that Phil Liggett didn't call it out as much as he could. And well, you know, or I'd just argue it's very difficult.
Of all the things that have happened to you, I want to bring you into the 90s now in a kind of pot-marked sort of chronological way. The Basque separatists going into an underground car park and torching your car.
Yeah, well, it actually wasn't. They'd blown a few up in the underground. Mine was on the surface.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, just outside of San Sebastian. And I'd come home for some reason reasonably late that night because we tend to go to bed early if the hotel had a restaurant. I'm not sure this one did. Paul and I drove up from the town, parked the car in the middle of this square. There's only a few cars there. I had a French Citroën. And then I went to bed.
Yeah.
And I got in bed, but I don't feel I was there that long when all of a sudden our sound guy banging on the door, Phil, we're not joking, your car's on fire. I said, yeah, right, I've got no clothes on, I'm not coming anywhere. No, seriously, your car is on fire. Somebody's put a bomb under it. I said, what? Well, by which time, half the camera crew had left, couldn't get out the front of the hotel because the car was actually in the foyer of the hotel, burning the hotel. The camera crew gone out through the windows with the cameras, ran round the square, got the pictures and sent them over to London ITV News, made the bloody headlines. And anyway, the car was a Citroën. It's one of the new plastic type cars of the era, and it totally melted into a little meatball and shoved onto the back of a flatbed. All my clothes were in there completely because I'd come in late. I didn't need to take them in the hotel. Paul had 50 CDs. Everyone was toast. That was good because I didn't like his music, but he knew that. And what I was sad about, ITV, the engineers, ITV, back in 1973, had made me a race radio that worked on the Tour de France. Mm. Now they tend a penny, but in those days they were hard to get hold of, and they made me one. That was in there, and that was destroyed. That broke my heart, that bit did. Anyway, the car was done for. We told Citroën. They said, anybody hurt? We said, no. They said, there'll be a new car waiting when you get to Bordeaux. The organisation loaned us a car free of charge because basically they felt somewhat at fault.
This summer will be the first time in 40 years that we won't have daily live coverage of each stage on
unbelievable
what we call terrestrial TV or you know free-to-air TV in the UK. You were, of course, there at the very start. Just give me your thoughts on that news. I mean, you said there already, you know, unbelievable.
My first thought was I feel so sorry for Ned, for Gary Imlach, and Miller. I just, what are these guys going to do? They were heartbroken. I mean, Ned is coming on the tour again this year, but we won't see him. He's on the race route.
Mm.
He's doing something, not for TV, but I was with him only 2 days ago, and he's going to be very, very sad in July.
Yeah.
Aren't we all? I mean, I was just absolutely broken because ITV had been the pioneers, something I don't think was ever fully recognised by the higher-ups of ITV.
I wonder now that the sport is not on, or the Tour de France is not going to be on sort of terrestrial TV, and you know, you're not part of the production anymore. How you reflect on it, and do you miss it, or are there elements of it that you're relieved that you're not there?
No, I think, I mean, obviously the tour hasn't happened yet, so I can't say I've missed it because we haven't missed it yet. But we will miss it. I'm finding it very difficult at the moment to follow much of cycling because it's all behind a paywall now. So, you know, unless you want to pay big sums of money, it's a bit trickier to, you know, I'm now back to how ordinary Joe's got to pay for it.
that summer holiday feel, that sort of vicarious journey that people have been used to going.
I think that
would be quite the same.
No, I don't think it's the same at all. And they cover the race in a different way. I mean, their highlights are not, they don't attempt to do that kind of vicarious journey around France. It's all about the racing. And it's all about just, you know, okay, here's that climb, here's that sprint. You know, here's that chunk, and then take an ad break, and here's another chunk. And that's forced on them in a sense by the fact they're doing it in, you know, multiple languages. So it's much more difficult to do a clever edit. All you, the best you can do is kind of tell 26 commentators, start talking now and stop talking now. And that's part one. It's a different game for them. And it's much more about the live than it is about the highlights.
Do you think ASO, the Tour de France organisers, has got a sense of what it might be losing here?
I don't think, I mean, to be fair, I don't think the decision wasn't anything to do with ASO. It was entirely ITV. So, yes, I think ASO knows what it might be losing, but it wasn't in ASO's power to do anything about. ITV simply decided they didn't want to do it anymore. It was purely a cost thing. And, you know, when ITV look at all the things they've got to pay for, you know, got World Cup year, it's all the rest of it, and they look at a line item and says, you know what, that's something that, you know, we can lose without too much pain. It's a relatively small audience. There's a saving we can make and put it towards something we care about, like football. You know, they've long had a bigger bid on the table, but chosen to keep the ITV option there. I mean, the last sort of 4 or 5 years, we, you know, although every stage was being covered live in its entirety, we were restricted to having, I think we had to lose something like 25 hours over the whole tour. So that Eurosport had the exclusive of the whole thing. And that was one of my tasks over the winter, was to pick which stages you were going to show in Fulham, where you were going to save the hours. But that was an attempt by ASO to keep that window open, as it were. So I think ASO recognised the value of a terrestrial broadcast. I think that's without doubt. It's just that the terrestrial broadcaster chose not to play.
Are you able to put a cost on what it cost ITV to, you know, have the rights?
I can give you an estimate of half of it. I don't know what they paid for the rights. That's entirely a deal that was done by ITV and ASO, and I wasn't party to that. But I mean, you're looking in terms of production costs north of £1 million. No, so it's not small money. And so you've got that plus whatever you're paying for the rights. But, you know, TV unfortunately is quite expensive to do, and there's tremendous pressure, you know, everywhere now to kind of make it cheaper. And you only make it cheaper by cutting corners, unfortunately.
So that's £1 million for 3 weeks of the live show and the highlights.
Yeah.
That's more than I thought, I must admit.
Yeah. You know, you're putting something like 15 to 20 people on the road. You've got another 15 to 20 people back in London doing the editing, all the equipment, you know, it's not a cheap operation. Now, that said, it pales into insignificance against, you know, what they would spend on doing the football. And I think we calculated that, you know, jokingly, that the cost of the Tour de France was about the same as their set at Maidstone when we were both at Maidstone together. But the football gets a huge audience and sponsorship and all the rest of it, so it earns the income so it can spend it.
To clarify on that, James, so the rights is based, that so your costs are in addition to the basically getting the pictures into the feed.
No, that would include bringing the pictures in,
right?
But you've got to do the deal with ASO for the rights to have the tour. And that's the bit I've got no idea what ITV are paying for that. But, you know, I think you can probably at least double that figure. You know, and so it's not an insignificant amount of money, and you have to weigh up what's the audience, is it attracting enough sponsorship and advertising revenue to make that back, and hopefully make a profit. And that, unfortunately, is the game TV's in. Make a profit, as every business. And, if it's not doing that, then it's easy for someone to say, you know what, let's stop doing it. And I suspect that's where we're at. Sadly.
Just something that's always, because people think that TV is easy because you turn on the telly and the pictures are there. And I obviously know Daniel very well. I know Stuart Hutchison, who I know has worked on your productions as well, on the production side. One of the things that always has interested me is when people say, why can't they just, do X, Y, or Z, and for example, just the cost of, say, putting up one helicopter for a day of the Tour de France. Have you got any idea what that would be?
Oh, I don't know in France, what they would pay. Because, again, you've got not just the helicopter, it's the equipment just to go on it. Just flying a helicopter for an hour is £700 plus for an hour. For an hour. And then you've got the equipment, the gyroscopic cameras and the cameraman to operate it and all of that. So, again, it's a lot of money. The Tour de France has, several helicopters up, through the day. For most of the day, there'll be more than one helicopter for just about all of the day, at least two in the air. And I think they'd have four or five helicopters that are kind of leapfrogging when one's refueling, another one's up, that kind of thing. The cost of producing, for French TV, of producing the Tour de France, I it would be astronomical. A lot of money,
and all the satellite time and everything else gets pictures into people's homes.
Well, the satellite time is something that is borne by the end user, i.e., ITV or whatever. So we would have to book that. You've got a lines bill of several hundred thousand pounds across the tour, which is this part of that figure that we talked about earlier. There's a big technical cost, and then you've got staffing costs and on top of that. But TV's not a cheap thing.
And then the viewers complain about the adverts. Which are paying for it all.
Think about which attempt to pay for it, exactly. I get it. No one wants to be taken away from the action. I chuckled because ITV started doing something I'd long been asking to do, which is adverts picture in picture, during the rugby over the winter. I don't know whether you saw that.
Yeah, I did.
And so, when people were complaining about that, and you go in, you've not left the pictures, you can see nothing's happening. They played an advert in whilst the referee is talking to them about something, or they're looking at a replay. You've missed absolutely nothing, and you can see you've missed nothing because the pictures were there all along, and still you're complaining. At some point, you're going to realise what's paying for it.
Well, the alternative is a monthly subscription, which makes it unaffordable for some and unwatchable and undesirable for others.
And still you get adverts on top of your subscription. you know.
Very true.
You know, you get, you pay your 30 quid a month, you don't get it ad-free, do you? You still got ad breaks. Maybe not as many.
Before we do go, I just want to thank you for one of the most challenging and almost embarrassing moments of my career, when I came to do a tryout in your commentary box in Ealing. And my God, prior to that, I was one of those, oh, it can't be that hard. It can't be that hard. And I had a newfound respect for all of the people who have done it before and continue to do it today. It is bloody hard.
You weren't far off that bad, actually. As I recall.
You're too kind.
You were in the mix. It was only that, I mean, initially that was kicked off by Ned saying he didn't want to do it. Mm. Ultimately persuaded Ned that he did want to do it. I think if Ned hadn't, there was yourself, Daniel, and Richard who were very much in the mix.
So tell me about how you'll be covering the tour this year.
Oh, in luxury. They give me a driver now. After we lost Paul, they decided they give me a driver, and they built me a beautiful yellow commentary box, which is always just past the finishing line. And it's enormous inside. It's air conditioned, which I actually hate. I turn it off, Bob Roll turns it back on. And we have big television screens. And this year I've just had my cataracts done on my eyes, so I can see what's going on now. I might get a better commentary, who knows. And people come and look at our commentary box now.
Mm.
And that's the biggest thing that's ever happened. But we have a wonderful team. It's a multinational team. You know, we have French organisation, sees everything works smoothly, who work totally for us. It's fluent English, of course, as well. And we have our own chef. Well, we had our own chef. That's gone now. Times have changed. But we get special chefs that look after us with food. I'm afraid I don't eat at lunchtimes. The chef thinks I'm dying or I'm ill. And he keeps sending me a plate of food over. I say, don't worry, chef. I don't eat when I'm working. But I'll be okay tonight. Come and join me. You can have a glass of wine. I've always said I've never had a job in my life. And I believe that. I've just converted my hobby. And it's taken me around the world. I've met the most famous people in the world. And it usually turns out they've all watched me. When I was given the MBE by the Queen in the palace, as soon as the Queen has said to me, this cycling is getting very popular now, isn't it? I said, yes, ma'am, it is. Next. So I walked off. And when I got behind where they put your medal in a box, the whole of the bookhouse staff were there saying, hey, come here. How'd you get this job? We all watch you in Buckingham Palace. I said, you what? We all watch you. We love you. How did you get the job? Tell us a bit about what you do. So the boxing of the medals was getting a bit behind when the other recipients coming through as well. But I just don't see myself as being anybody but me. And I remember I was mobbed one day at the railing, because you're fenced in at the tour, and these people were screaming. And one woman was crying. I said, why are you crying? She says, you're real. I'm looking at you. But I don't know what to say. But the organisation walked past. It wasn't Christian. It was one of the other big hitters. And they said, Phil, you're very popular, eh? I said, apparently, yes. And yeah.
But it becomes a very personal thing. And people think of you almost as narrating their summers.
They do.
They almost invite you into their home.
Yeah.
And therefore, to an extent, they do feel like they know you, because your voice is so familiar.
They do. And a life story.
And this constant sort of, you know, throughout their lives as well. So, I mean, I think...
Which I appreciate, because it means you're doing a good job. They're not throwing tomatoes.
Yeah.
But, you know, I walk through the airports, through international airports all the time. Somebody walk over and say, Phil Liggett, right? I said, yeah. God, do you know how old I was when I started watching you? I said, I don't wish to know the answer to that. And then he said, now I'm married, I've got two kids, and so the story starts. I could write a book on these people.
Mm.
But I'm very appreciative they feel they will let me know.
Yeah. Phil, good luck for this year's tour. The American audience will be very lucky to have you in their ears.
Yeah.
But we hope you enjoy it, and thank you again for sharing some of your experience with us on the Cycling Podcast.
Oh, thank you very much indeed. It's nice to tell somebody.
Next time, we'll feature a rider who experienced the extreme highs and the plunging lows of the Tour de France in a single day 40 years ago. This episode of Kilometre Zero for the Cycling Podcast featured me, Lionel Burney, and Graham Wilgos.
Thanks to our guests James Venner and Phil Liggett. The episode was produced by Adam Bowden.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed and Lionel Byrne.
This message is brought to you by the Capital One Venture X card. Venture X offers the premium benefits you expect, like a $300 annual Capital One travel credit for less than you expect. Elevate your earn with unlimited double miles on every purchase, bringing you one step closer to your next dream destination. Plus, enjoy access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. The Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.